What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends with John Krofcik and Larry Rifkin. Is that my name still?
Oh, boy. I'm not sure.
Boy, I'm getting old, aren't I? See, I can only keep so much information in my head. And my name, why do I have to remember that, John?
That's true. You're right.
No, I do have to remember that because every time...
It's on your license.
Oh, okay. So I can just, yeah, you know, that's a good point that when you, all else fails, just open up your wallet and be reminded. No, but when you think about it, John, you call any of these new customer relations AI places, and you've got to give them the same information over and over. Your name, yeah. Your date of birth, sometimes your social security number. Some do that with some sense of concern or reluctance.
Or your mother's maiden name or
yeah, all these crazy. Different prompts. Actually, I have one where your voice print is your identification as opposed to your facial identification.
You better hope your voice doesn't change.
I know. Well, that's the thing. What happens, like particularly with facial recognition, if somebody has plastic surgery, I mean, what happens after that?
Ooh, I don't know. They're locked out.
I know, absolutely. Well, we are talking about the future always on America Trends, social, political change. And sometimes we have to step back and look at the architecture of change. And one of the big pieces to the new architecture, John, in the world is a thing called blockchain.
Yeah, that's supposed to change the world, the blockchain.
Now, you and I grew up with blockhead, which I'm not certain you're supposed to use that terminology. You're a blockhead. I don't know if that is verboten
these
days.
Now we got blockheads with chains.
Right, with chains on. Yeah, I've seen a few. But the blockchain and the new architecture of trust. Now, this is what underpins all of this technology that we call cryptocurrency,
right,
and Bitcoin and whatever else we want to call it. You've got to have this blockchain technology in place or none of it really works. I mean, it's real underpinning. It's kind of like the grid, if you will, of all this futuristic stuff about right. money and exchanges.
Well, it makes it traceable, and that's the main thing, and it keeps it secure. Traceable and secure.
And what people don't quite get, I think, is the fact that what we're talking about here is basically an open architecture that allows us all to check each other. And it avoids us having to trust a bank. Well, we lost a lot of trust in banks in 2008.
That's true.
And it's barely recovered, if it has. But these shared ledgers of information that nobody really controls, John, but everyone, they say, can believe in. Now, this is a lot of the questioning that we do about this with Kevin Weirbach, because how do we know that this is any more reliable than anything else, particularly opening it up to lots of folks who might want to.
I got the answer to that because they say so.
They say so. Okay. Well, this is only about a decade old, and of course, we are already, I think, in a way, past Bitcoin.
Right. But the blockchain is the important.
Ah, so the blockchain continues, emerges as a major force, and we move past what we all identified as the most, well, visible element right. of blockchain.
Right.
Is that Absolutely. The way it goes?
That's the way it goes. That's the part that they've developed that seems to be what's going to change transactions on the web in the future, but we'll see.
And I think a lot of people are going to be surprised to hear how many companies that you work with, that you know, that you do business with, are actually starting to rely upon blockchain, including Walmart and the New York Stock Exchange. So it's wholly misunderstood. We're going to try to help you sort it all out today.
That's good. I need that.
Yeah, no, it really is an important topic. Kevin Weirbach joining us now on America Trends. With us on the line is Kevin Weirbach, and the book is called The Blockchain and the New Architecture of Trust. And let's start with terms. Blockchain, Help us to understand what it means.
Absolutely. There's a lot of confusion out there. So blockchain is basically a kind of decentralized database. It's a way of storing information, but no one entity controls it. So it's a way that you can exchange things of value where people on the network can be confident in what they're getting. Everyone on the network is seeing the same information, but there's no central control point. So the first real use of this technology was Bitcoin, which is what's called a cryptocurrency. And so Bitcoin uses the blockchain technology to create money. So you can be confident that if you send money from your account or from your wallet to someone else, that what they get is what you intended them to get, that there's no double spending of the same coins, even though it doesn't go through a bank, even though there's no government issuing the coins. That turns out to be a much broader technology that can be used for really any kind of value exchange. And so there's lots of different applications being developed.
Blockchain is to Bitcoin as, could you fill in the blank there, so that people understand how important one is to the other?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say blockchain is to Bitcoin as the internet is to Google or Facebook. It's the underlying mechanism of exchanging information securely that is the foundation for different kinds of applications.
But it's interesting that when you talked about the banks and said, well, they're out of the loop and so forth, and now you can go directly. Now, this notion of shared ledgers goes back to almost antiquity. But we established many of these institutions, banks and others, to give us the comfort that there was actually an honorable middleman who could perhaps settle any disputes we might have with others.
Oh, absolutely. And that's, you know, people in the cryptocurrency and blockchain world like to say that this is the end of trust. The problem is we need systems that we don't have to trust at all. And I actually think that's wrong. It's why the book is called The New Architecture of Trust, because what blockchain does is it creates a new structure where you can trust the results of the system. You can trust the transaction without having to trust any particular actor. So traditionally, you're right, there are a number of structures of trust that have emerged, but all of them, whether it's trusting the middleman, whether it's trusting the government to enforce contracts, whether it's trusting the counterparty, you trust your friend, your relative, or whatever, all of them break down when that other entity is not trustworthy. And all of them have the problem that because you don't necessarily fully trust everyone you're dealing with, there's duplication of information. You want to keep your own copy of information and make sure it's the same as the copy of information that someone else has, because you don't necessarily want to trust their copy of information without having a copy yourself. And then what happens if they're not in sync? There has to be a process of reconciliation. So all of these things build up lots and lots of intermediaries, additional costs, additional errors, and inefficiencies in systems that we use not just for finance, but for the way goods and services move all around the world.
Is a lot of this like Wikipedia, where in effect everybody can edit, and yet we find, at least in some of the materials I've been reading, that it is as accurate as most encyclopedias that are edited very heavily?
Yeah, so it's an interesting analogy. At a high level, yes. At a level that is basically talking about decentralized systems. There's been, you know, a great recognition for the last 20 years that what my friend and colleague Yochai Benkler calls social production or peer production systems like Wikipedia can actually be very powerful because they motivate people on different reasons. People don't edit Wikipedia pages because they're getting paid by the company. They do it because they're interested in the topic matter or for all sorts of other motivations. Blockchain is in that same general category that it's decentralized, but it works a little bit differently. It actually relies on incentives. So in a system like Bitcoin, people called miners are competing to validate the network, to accurately verify transactions. And they're doing it for selfish reasons. They're doing it because there's essentially a lottery. If they're the first one to complete an arbitrary cryptographic mathematical puzzle every 10 minutes, they get free Bitcoin. They get roughly something like $40,000 today of Bitcoin every 10 minutes. And so they're competing that way, but in that competition, they are accurately verifying transactions. And anyone who wants to cheat the network is competing against this massive, massive amount of computational power of all the existing miners. So the result is similar to something like Wikipedia. Yes, you get accuracy without central control, but it's not reliant on the same sort of community values that animate something like Wikipedia. And that's partly what gets me to write about this, because there still needs to be something more than just that base level selfishness to get an accurate transaction for the whole system to be trustworthy.
So what is it that's missing at this point that will have to ultimately arrive to make this something that is globally accepted?
Well, it's trust at higher levels. And the institutions of society that have developed for a very long time to promote trust are things like law and regulation and governance. And so even though Bitcoin and blockchain technology were originally developed by people who were trying to create something totally outside of the existing governmental structure, we need to find ways to harmonize these technological systems and the kind of trust that's produced by the software code and the cryptography that they use, harmonize those with the more traditional systems of regulatory oversight, of legal enforcement, and so forth. Because let's say you do a transaction that gets automatically put through on one of these networks, and it's a incorrect transaction. There's a mistake because mm-hmm. there's a bug. You need some dispute resolution mechanism. Now, there's really fascinating work going on creating decentralized online dispute resolution mechanisms, what are called oracles and arbitration systems on the blockchain. Very immature, and they're never going to quite replace the existing system, but they may at some point do some of it. For now, really your best bet is you want to be able to go to a court and go to an impartial system that you can trust to be a backstop. So there's a whole set of these areas where basically we need to work through what are the right combinations of the technical trust that a blockchain provides with the more traditional human-based trust that's embedded in law and governance.
We understand often that regulators are well behind the technology. And in this case, I mean, there's great incentive for governments to want to know what's going on with blockchain, because they want to track money so they can tax it and promote various forms of growth or limit banned behavior. What's going on in terms of the government's role in all of this?
Yeah, so governments have many different motivations. It's easy to say governments are this, but you know, are you talking about the government of the state of Wyoming, or are you talking about the government of China and everything in between?
Mm-hmm.
So governments want to provide benefits for their citizens, and governments certainly want to promote innovation, especially given that this is a global environment where governments in places like the United States are looking at what other governments are doing in this area. And so, you know, the question is, what does it take to meet their public policy objectives? And one set of public policy objectives is to prevent crime and money laundering and to enforce when that happens. One set of public policy objectives is to provide good information, for example, to investors. So one of the biggest issues with blockchain has been these ICOs, initial coin offerings, where the concern is not to stamp them out. The concern is there's tremendous propensity for fraud and scams when people are throwing money at things they don't understand, where there's really no mechanism of getting good information. So government regulators are trying to figure out, how do we provide protection and disclosure to investors, at the same time not necessarily forcing the whole blockchain world into the limitations of the traditional system? And then, frankly, you know, governments are interested in things that work more efficiently and things that work better for their citizens. So it's absolutely true that they want to see the transactions, but they also want to see more flexibility so that people engage in more transactions. We've seen lots of problems, for example, where government systems have been hacked because they've got massive amounts of centralized data. Mm. So the idea of decentralizing data, if you can decentralize the data and still allow, for example, government to do its work, which is what a lot of the new blockchain-based identity systems do, they allow you to verify information. If you want to check that someone is over 21 to see if they can get a drink, or you want to check if they have a degree they claim on their diploma. You can do that without actually centralizing the information. That's actually something that's really appealing to government. And so a lot of the cutting-edge research work in some of these areas actually be funded by government agencies.
Let's talk about some of the other blockchain-based services that have sprung up, tracking these academic certificates or electronic medical records. I mean, give us examples of how that works.
Yeah, so again, the blockchain technology is separate from the cryptocurrencies, which is the money that can run on top of it. And you don't even necessarily need the cryptocurrencies themselves, especially if you're doing what's called a permission blockchain, where everything is decentralized, but you want to know who's on the network. You don't let anyone get on the network. You have some verification about basic identity, and then it's decentralized at that point. Anything that involves multiple organizations who don't fully trust each other needing to exchange information has this trust problem I talked about, that they're going to duplicate information and there's going to be inefficiencies when they want to send it around. So, you know, we had this huge romaine lettuce E. coli outbreak, and they had to throw out, you know, all the lettuce in America because no one has a universal view into all the lettuce moving through that supply chain around the country, even though technically to create a database that would check all those points is fairly trivial today. Doesn't happen. Why doesn't it happen? Because there's thousands of different independent actors who don't trust each other. And so blockchain is a technology, and for example, IBM and Walmart are building a system for just this application that can make it possible to share that information. There's one shared ledger everyone can see, which they're willing to trust. It's not under the control of just one player. So that's a good example. There's lots of good examples in shipping and logistics. As you said, things like healthcare, where we have, you know, massive inefficiencies, that there are all these different fragmented electronic medical records. Again, having a system where you control your data, but other actors can find the information they need. They don't need to get you to give up your information just to verify something. We now have the cryptography and the mathematical technology to do that when things are distributed on a blockchain network.
When you look at the distrust that is built into the current system, did a lot of this perhaps go back to the financial crisis of 10 years ago? Because you say that this work that you've done is really the first work of legal scholarship on the blockchain as a repository of social and economic trust. How far back do we have to go to try to, you know, repair the damage that's been done by the traditional system?
Yeah, so the Bitcoin white paper was published on Halloween 2008, so right in the midst of the financial crisis. It wasn't per se a response to the financial crisis, because it was something that he was working on, the author, for some time before. Mm-hmm. But clearly that environment was a big reason why this technology took off when it did. But that was not the first time that there had been an undermining of trust. There I talk in the book about some of the studies that have been done over the last 20 years showing the dramatic fall of trust in many parts of the world, but especially in the United States, across government, across corporations, across media, and so forth. So this is a long-standing problem. And it's not that blockchain is going to magically solve it. That's, again, part of the argument of the book, is you can solve the base-level trust problem to be confident that this asset went from here to there, but there's still a lot more that you have to trust to believe in and feel comfortable in the overall system. But I think, you know, this technology can be a tool in rebuilding a form of trust. This is another reason why, you know, back to the previous question, I think governments are interested, because governments understand that they're not trusted. And governments understand that we're in a period where trust is really crumbling. And so they're looking for mechanisms where they can say, look, we are going to cede control to this decentralized system. We're going to make sure that, you know, our interests are met, because we have a goal of having accurate information. If you're the local records office for real property registration, you want to make sure that that's done accurately. But then you don't need to be the one that controls all the data. You want to be able to access the data. But as long as it's accurate, you can actually decentralize in a way which makes it more trustworthy. So I definitely see this technology as a potential to push back on the destruction of trust that's happened. But again, it requires that harmonization, where there has to be a willingness to work through the places where without some further action, law and governance and so forth are in opposition to the blockchain.
Kevin Werbach is with us, the blockchain and the new architecture of trust. So what is the human role that is essential to the performance and the development of more uses for blockchain?
Well, it's all the way through. It's humans understanding what the use cases are, understanding what the right application of blockchain is. I hear all the time people saying, there's a blockchain for this, I can use a blockchain for that. And most of these uses are things you don't need a blockchain for. So part of it is the design process of understanding, is this a situation where there is a breakdown in trust because there are different actors that don't trust each other? Can something be digitized and put on this immutable network? But then there needs to be human governance processes to anticipate what happens if something goes wrong. What happens if, for example, the network isn't running fast enough and there's choices that have to be made about how to change the underlying technology of the network? What happens if there's a theft? There was a famous incident called the DAO 2 years ago where there was a decentralized crowdfunding platform, like a Kickstarter that was created on one of these decentralized blockchains. Mm-hmm. Someone hacked it. Someone found a bug in these smart contracts, sucked out $60 million. Mm. Clear theft. Everyone knew it was theft. But then what do you do about it? Again, no one had the power to roll it back. So the whole community had this very fractious discussion. They eventually split the entire blockchain in half, which was a very, very disruptive process and not something you'd want to do many times. That was because they didn't really have an established governance process to say, what do we do in a case like this? And it turns out there's been a great deal of research by scholars. There's a woman named Eleanor Ostrom who won the Nobel Prize in Economics a number of years ago, studying governance in decentralized, commons-based organizations. There are a variety of principles that can be brought to bear, and we need to basically work through and build these human systems to deal with inevitable situations where things go wrong.
If we can concretize this even more for people, I mean, Walmart, for example, is now using blockchain, as is the New York Stock Exchange. Help us to understand how they've applied it.
Well, sure. So Walmart is doing a lot of supply chain work. So I think I mentioned the lettuce tracking. They have a system that they've built that will be able to track all the way from the farms all around the world. Requires a process of RFID chips to check in and so forth. But every time some leafy greens move from one point to another in their distribution network, this is a massive, massive network around the world, that gets checked in and recorded on a ledger. And so the trial that they did was that the head of food safety there, who's now actually left to go to the Federal Food and Drug Administration to work on this for the government, he asked his team, he said, okay, let's say someone eats this, he was talking, the example was mangoes, a tin of mangoes or a container of mangoes that pulled off a shelf at Walmart, and that person gets sick. How long would it take you to figure out which farm in the world it came from? And Walmart runs one of the most technologically efficient, sophisticated supply chains in the world. Put their experts on it, 6.5 days, how long it took them to figure that out, which is why you get things like this massive recall we've had with the romaine lettuce. They put it on this blockchain network, where again, it's now in one ledger all around the world. The 6 days became 2.5 seconds. So that's a really powerful example that they're now rolling out in lots of other areas. Organizations like the parent company of the New York Stock Exchange, they're building trading systems. They are looking at Bitcoin and these other cryptocurrencies as assets that can be traded. They are purely digital assets. They're what are called programmable assets. So you can create more sophisticated financial products on those markets than you could trading around traditional assets. That's going to be a big area of activity where there's just a lot of financial activity around it. But I find it less interesting in terms of really transforming the way business works because it's basically plugging into the existing trading structure.
I believe in the introduction to your book, there was a quote, "The output of the system as a whole can be trusted, even if some of its components cannot." What does that say to us?
Well, that says to us that this is not the absence of trust. So it's a mistake to think we can ever get away from needing to trust. Well, we need to focus on what do we trust? And what does it take to make a system as a whole trustworthy as opposed to trusting in a particular middleman? Are you more comfortable trusting that your bank is taking your best interest to heart and holding your money and your information securely? Or are you more comfortable trusting a system where there's no bank, there's no particular actor like that, But there have to be these additional layers of governance and of dispute resolution and mechanisms in place to prevent the system from falling apart. So, you know, it gets us, I think, hopefully to think about the different kinds of things that we're trusting. We, you know, we have had this whole outbreak in recent months with Facebook, where people didn't realize just how much they were trusting that company with how much of their very personal information. And whatever happens, I think it's healthy to step back and think about, well, you know, what is the nature of the trust relationships we're getting into? And if we're uncomfortable, if we realize that it's a problem that one company dominates so much, is there another path? And while there's tremendous uncertainty about how this is going to go, I think one of the reasons that so many of the most brilliant people I come into contact with now are excited about blockchain technology, if there's anything that is going to rewire the internet over the next 20 or 30 years, to make it more decentralized, to overcome this kind of original sin where it's become concentrated in a few players. This is it.
All right. Well, I love to have a way to conclude this conversation as definitive as that. This is it. Kevin Werbach, The Blockchain and the New Architecture of Trust. I thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.